This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome to the New Books in Japanese Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Raditya, your host for this episode, and today we are joined by Dr. David Wise, which is currently assistant professor at Kyushu University, to talk about his latest monograph, The God Susanoo and Korea in Japan's Cultural Memory, Ancient Myths and Modern Empire. Before we get into the book, perhaps we can start with a short self-introduction, David, for our listeners who may not be familiar with you or your work.
Sure. Hi, Raditya, and thank you very much for having me here on your podcast. So, as you mentioned, my name is David Wise. I am working as an assistant professor at Kyushu University at the moment. I earned my degree in Germany at the University of Tübingen, and the major research areas or questions that interest me are, first of all, cultural memory. So the idea of how images of the past are created and how they change in different periods in accordance to historical or social changes, and how these images of the past play an important role in constructing or maintaining collective identities. And of course, this is also closely connected to the idea of mythology and of myths. So origin stories and how these origin stories are reinterpreted in different periods, and how they are used also in a political way for justifying or legitimating current practices. So this is one of my major research interests. The other one is perceptions of cultural others. So I'm very interested in Japanese, or in the history of Japanese-Korean relations, and how perceptions of Korea and Koreans changed within Japanese intellectual history, and what role Korea played in creating a Japanese cultural identity. So I always have problems of focusing on one specific period, because I'm very much interested in these long-term processes of reception and, seeing basically the changes in how things are reinterpreted. Yes, so I guess that's the most important points about my research.
Great. Yeah, thank you for sharing that. And thank you for getting straight into the sort of cultural memory point. That was actually one of the questions I'll be asking you soon. But maybe we can go back to that point later. Yeah, so I mean, the book sort of explores the association of sort of this deity, Susanoo, with Korea, and as I've mentioned, throughout various time periods. But I do feel like there seems to be a bit of a focus given to especially the colonial period. But again, maybe we can touch a bit more on this later. A fascinating topic indeed. But before we sort of jump into the book, and you've mentioned this a bit earlier, but maybe you can share some of the sort of processes that led to the sort of the start of this project. How did this sort of project begin?
So first of all, it basically started with my fascination for really this figure, this mythical figure, Susanoo. I first encountered him during my undergrad studies in a seminar on Japanese ancient history and intellectual history. And I was just fascinated by this god. So he's depicted as the little brother of the sun goddess. And this sun goddess Amaterasu is basically this very perfect goddess who never really makes any mistakes and is just very dignified. And then you have her little brother who is just a never-do-well. So he breaks all of the taboos. And while it is very clear that Amaterasu played a very political role as well as the ancestress of the imperial family, I was always wondering, why would you leave a figure like Susanoo, who clearly defies all authority, also imperial authority, in a mythical chronicle. That's basically there are two chronicles that are very important in this regard, which are the Kojiki and the Nihonshoki, and both of them were compiled in the early 8th century at the imperial court. So both of them clearly have the as their major objective to justify imperial rule. So why would you leave a figure in there that has a very important role and clearly defies imperial authority? So that's basically how my fascination with Susanoo started. And then later on, as I also got interested in Japanese-Korean relations, I came upon these modern interpretations that connected Susanoo very strongly with Korea. And of course, here my two major research interests of basically images of the alien and images of the past more or less coalesced. So it was for me a rather clear aim to work on this topic. And then I just wanted to find out how Susanoo is actually connected to Korea. So in the first step, I was very much interested in, let's say, mythical motifs that moved from the Korean Peninsula to Japan and can be found in the ancient myths. But later on, I got more and more interested in the reception of all of this and how basically images of Korea were connected to this liminal and unpredictable figure. And so basically the back and forth between those images of Susanoo and of Korea. As you pointed out, there is definitely a certain focus on the colonial period, which is just because this is the period where it becomes clearest that Susanoo very much serves as a foil to Amaterasu. So there was this theory of common ancestry of Japanese and Koreans, and which said that basically the Japanese and the Koreans are one ethnic group. or had been in the past, and therefore they should be rejoined, which was, of course, used to justify colonial rule. And in this discourse, Amaterasu was considered as the ancestress of the Japanese people, and Susanoo as the ancestor of the Korean people. So this was a very nice place to basically start off the whole discussion. And then I tried to frame the whole book as basically a genealogy. So how did it come to this? Where did this discourse come from?
Yeah, definitely. Very, very interesting. I mean, this sort of figure, Susanoo, I think if you're somewhat familiar with sort of the myths, you've heard the name. But yeah, I mean, you know, taking a closer look at sort of this deity, and then especially if you contrast him with sort of Amaterasu, sort of coming from my own interest more in sort of the sort of popular cultural realm, it is interesting because you do see this figure, you know, sort of taking more of a sort of backstage approach, even in sort of various sort of reinterpretations of him in popular culture compared to like Amaterasu. But yeah, thank you sort of for sort of that explanation. And I mean, I guess you've touched on this before as well, but the book is basically divided into two main parts. And the first part is sort of more focused on sort of the myths surrounding sort of this sort of deity Susanoo, sort of looking at Yonchoki and sort of Kojiki. And then the second part, sort of where you explore later sort of interpretations or reinterpretations of Susanoo in Imperial Japan. And I mean, I think the structure makes a lot of sense, and this makes the book a lot easier to read. But how did you sort of come up with this structure, and is there sort of a particular reason or like a goal that you have in mind by sort of choosing to split the book into sort of these two parts?
That is an excellent question, because I have to admit that I struggled with this for quite some years, because this book is based on my PhD thesis, and the structure of my PhD thesis was completely different, and it didn't work, because if you look at something for such a long or over such a long time range, it is important to somehow define the red thread, basically what you want to show. And so what I ended up doing for this book is focusing very much on the reception history. And you could say the first, so that's basically the second part. So the second part tells you how Susanoo and his connection to the Korean Peninsula was reinterpreted in different periods. And also the idea behind this structure is that there is some kind of continuity. So if you look at theoretical concepts like the invention of tradition, you can easily get the impression that a lot of traditions were just invented from scratch in the modern period, which is not true. You always have to build on something that is already there. So it's always a selection from basically, yes, you could say historical antecedents. And the second part is supposed to show what the intellectuals in the Meiji period who tried to use Susanoo in order to justify colonial rule, what they could draw on, actually. So what were the primary sources they could use, but also what were the pre-existing interpretations they could use? Because this really limits the scope of possible interpretations, I would say. So if you came up with something completely new, just nobody would believe you. And but first, in order for this second part to make any sense, I had to explain the whole argument in the first part. So here I tried to first show a very rough sketch of Japanese images of Korea and how they changed over history, of course, with a special focus on the Meiji period. And then to introduce this figure of Susanoo Oh, again with a special focus on his relationship to Amaterasu, this very contrasting relationship between the two. And then this idea of Susanoo Oh as a liminal character, because I think this is also, this is what sets him apart basically from Amaterasu, who is a very stable character, doesn't move around a lot, and you know very much what she will do next. So she's very predictable. And on the other hand, Susanoo Oh basically travels through all the mythical realms of this mythical cosmos, and you never know what he will do next. So he can break taboos and make things that don't really seem to make any sense. And in the next moment, he will be the great hero who defeats a dragon and saves a maiden in distress. So I wanted to introduce this in the first part, and then also already hint at how this was used in the colonial period. And then, so to speak, the second part is the historical background that leads up to it. So yes, it took a long time to come up with that structure, but by now I'm rather happy with it.
Okay, yeah. Definitely. Thank you. Interesting. Okay, so to go back to sort of this idea of cultural memory, which is definitely central to sort of the book, can you maybe explain a bit more on sort of what cultural memory is and how specifically how sort of this concept sort of applies to Susanoo Oh or sort of to myths in sort of general or in your research?
Mm-hmm. So the concept of cultural memory is rather broad. So it was framed by Aleida and Jan Assmann, who are two German researchers with very different specializations, actually. So Jan Assmann works on ancient Egyptology and Aleida Assmann on modern literature, and they are married. This already explains why this is a very interdisciplinary approach. And it's basically concerned with the idea of how elites create and structure an image of the past that helps to make sense of the present, to justify institutions as they are at the moment, and how this image of the past has to be anchored in basically each individual's memory. And in order to do that, you have to come up with, you have to come up with education. So tell people what is important about the past, how they should think about the past. You can build statues, you can build museums, just to make sure that everyone encounters these images of the past again and again, and basically interpret their own lives also and their own idea of belonging according to these images of the past. And obviously, this is not a modern phenomenon, but this was always done, even in pre-literate times. There were rituals that were repeated again and again. Normally, you have religious rituals that are connected to certain seasons. And often these religious rituals are not directly connected to the natural changes that happen during these seasons, but are also connected to some historical event, to some founding memory of a religion. And to bring it back to Susanoo Oh and my own research, obviously these chronicles, Kojiki and Nihonshoki. So Kojiki is the oldest extant piece of literature we have in Japan. They were ordered by the imperial court, and especially in the preface of the Kojiki, there's a very clear explanation of the goal of this compilation or also standardization of mythology, which basically says that it is important to hand on the right ideas about the past in order to make the government work and to make people understand imperial rule. And for that, it is also important to weed out all the wrong things that have crept into basically collective memory. So already in the 8th century, we see in Japan a very clear understanding from the imperial court that they need to control the past in order to justify their rule in the present. Of course, this was not only the chronicles, this was also backed up by court ritual and by many other also more political reforms. But then basically this is something you can see throughout Japanese intellectual history, at least until the end of the Second World War, that the myths were always interpreted by intellectuals and were always connected to the present and to present political developments, also to religious developments. Yes, you could argue that they have become much less important after the end of World War II. But they definitely play a very important role in Japan's cultural memory from the earliest sources we have until the modern period.
Yeah, interesting. Sort of when I was reading on sort of this concept as well, it's certainly interesting to think about, because it encourages the idea that, you know, traditions, myths, practices, as something more that's just, you know, that we shouldn't take that for granted, right? As in, like, there's often a sort of political attempt, sort of political motif, but also a specific purpose behind, well, these myths, right? They're not just there as sort of narrative stories. But yeah, definitely sort of an interesting concept, and I can see why it's sort of very applicable to sort of this this topic as well, to sort of Susanoo. So in chapter one, you sort of discuss various images of sort of Korea and the Japanese cultural imagination in the various time periods as well. Can you maybe talk a little bit more on this? What are some of the main perceptions of Korea, and where some of the texts where we can sort of look at these sort of images of Korea?
Mm-hmm. Okay, sure. So basically the first images we know of appear in these ancient sources, in the Kojiki and the Nihonshoki. And perhaps the most dominant one, at least in the early parts of these chronicles, is that Korea is basically a land of riches. So there are a lot of passages that refer to Korea as a land where there is a lot of gold and jewels. And of course, you also have, so the most famous episode is probably leading up to the legend of Jingu Kogo's conquest of Korea, where basically her husband, the Emperor Chuai, gets an oracle from some deities that tell him to go to Korea and get the great treasures there. And he basically says, I cannot see something beyond the sea, so Korea doesn't exist, and he doesn't basically believe in the oracle and dies shortly afterward. And then Chingu Kogo, his wife, takes up this role, and basically, so here we already see this idea that Japan wants to get treasures from Korea. And this reappears at some points in the chronicle. Then you also, of course, have depictions of Korea. Perhaps one has to differentiate a little bit. Obviously, there were more than one kingdoms on the Korean Peninsula. And Japan had very close connections to two of them, to Paekje and Kaya, the Kaya Federation, which was not really one of the kingdoms, but yeah, a federation of different states. And for instance, there is a very long episode on how Buddhism was brought to Japan from Paekje. So here we have this very, very positive image of Korea as a very prosperous land with an advanced civilization. On the other hand, we also have the idea that Korea can be a threat to Japanese security. So, for instance, the Yamato state formed an alliance with Paekje, with one of the states that were on the Korean peninsula, and became embroiled in a war with another state, Silla. And Silla won out in the end, which led to quite some worries on the Japanese, well, in Japan, that basically Silla, that had itself formed an alliance with the Tang China, that they might come and invade Japan. And of course, this image was then or resurfaced with the Mongol invasions that also used Korean ships and also basically forced Koreans to fight for them. So here we basically have this idea that that Korea is can either attack Japan directly or is so weak that they can be invaded by some other force and then serve as a foothold to attack Japan. And then a third very important pre-modern image was that Korea is basically a vassal state of Japan, but they are ungrateful and do not really bring the tribute they promised. Of course, this is connected to this legend of Chingu Kogo. So according to the legend, Chingu Kogo had invaded all of the Korean kingdoms, and they had sworn to bring tribute from then on. But apparently, this had never happened in historical Japan. So Japanese elites started to question why that was. And the most face-saving answer for Japanese elites was, yeah, the Koreans just don't keep to their promises. And of course, this was reactivated also in the modern period basically see this as a historical precedent of Japanese rule over Korea. And then what was a new idea that came in the modern period was that Korea became a part of Japan's Orient, you could say. So they were seen as not civilized compared to the civilized West. So Japan tried to become a part of the civilized West and basically leave Asia. And Korea was one of the countries that was used to visualize this kind of backward Asia. So this is basically where a real rupture occurs. So these three pre-modern images I have been talking about are reoccur again and again. But the first one, that Korea is a country of advanced civilization, was basically turned on its head in the modern period. So this really changed in the modern period. Yes, and of course, Susanoo also played a role in visualizing these images, especially of Korea being backward or also being immature, not able to rule themselves, impulsive, childish. So that's how it connects to the figure of Susanoo.
Yeah, that's really interesting. So especially because you see how sort of different modern sort of interpretation of these images. They're not based on nothing, I guess, right? Just because in the pre-modern times, you have sort of text and you have sort of images of Korea that they were sort of basing on. And then Susanoo sort of, I guess, enters the sort of the story there. And then you have, you know, sort of this new construction in the modern times. Very interesting. Okay, so speaking of sort of Susanoo, in chapter 2, you sort of explore different narratives of Susanoo in Nihon Shoki, in Kojiki, and in Izumo Fudoki. We've been talking about Susanoo for a lot throughout sort of this podcast, but maybe you can sort of dig deeper into sort of this deity and sort of tell us how different he's portrayed in sort of these different texts, in these three texts particularly.
Mm-hmm. Great. So Susanoo is, well, basically the one of the major new findings of mythological or of studies of Japanese myths in the last few decades has been to no longer try to reconstruct basically an original Japanese mythology. So for a long time, scholars have tried to basically use the most of all the Kojiki and the Nihon Shoki in order to reconstruct some oral tradition that is somehow reflected, or they claimed is reflected in those two chronicles. And one newer approach that is very much linked to the scholar Konoshi Takamitsu is to regard each of these chronicles as an independent literary work. And to very clearly separate them. And this approach has shown that there are indeed very important differences also between the Kojiki and the Nihon Shoki, even though both of them are very closely connected to the imperial court and definitely share a common goal of justifying imperial rule. But at the same time, they do this in very different ways. The most obvious one is that in the Kojiki, you have basically one mythological plot that is coherent in itself. Whereas in the Nihon Shoki, you have one main narrative and then a lot of variants to these narratives that are often mutually contradictory. And especially for this topic of Susanoo's connection to Korea, this is a very important point because this connection does not at all appear in the Kojiki, and it also doesn't appear in the main narrative of the Nihon Shoki, but it only appears in very isolated variants within the Nihon Shoki that are not at all connected to the overall plot. And this to also bring back this idea of cultural memory again, this shows you that well, how selective all of this is. So in the colonial period, or also in other periods, when Susanoo's connection to Korea was addressed, then this very isolated variant, which is normally not well known, really takes center stage. And so just to give a very, very rough outline of the plot about Susanoo in the Kochiki and also in the main narrative of the Nihonshoki, he's basically born from the primordial father, Izanagi, as the little brother of the sun goddess Amaterasu and the moon god Tsukuyomi. And each of these children is assigned to rule over one sphere of the mythical cosmos. According to the variants, these spheres differ somewhat. But what is always the same is that Susanoo does not follow this task. So he does not rule, but just screams and basically screams and cries, which leads to chaos in his realm and to many people dying. And then he's banished by his father Izanagi and goes up to Amaterasu's realm, the plane of high heaven, saying that he wants to say farewell to her. And there he basically commits all of these outrages. So he destroys her rice paddies. He defecates in the most sacred precinct, where she's basically ritually costing the new rice. And in the end, he basically all of these outrages result in Amaterasu hiding away in a rock cave, which deprives all of the world from sunlight. And more chaos erupts until the other deities find a way to lure Amaterasu out again. And then Susanoo is banished again and descends from the plane of high heaven in Izumo, so the present-day Shimane prefecture, where he turns into something of a local hero. So here he fights an eight-headed dragon and saves a maiden who is supposed to be sacrificed to it. And then in the Kochiki, only in the Kochiki here, he appears again as the ruler of the land of roots, which is one of the other worlds. And that's basically the whole plot. And the one variant that most strongly connects him to Korea is that after being banished from the plane of high heaven, he does not descend to Izumo directly, but first goes to Shilla, to the Korean kingdom of Shilla, stays there for a while, and then builds a boat and crosses over to Izumo. And this was then in the colonial period used to say that Susanoo is actually the founder of Korea. And that means that Japanese and Koreans are one ethnic group. And then we have this third source that also comes from the early 8th century, the Izumo Fudoki. This was also compiled in response to an imperial order, but not at the imperial court itself, but all of the provinces had to submit basically topographies. So they had to write about the quality of the land, what kind of crops were grown there, what kind of products could be produced, and also the names of all the towns and villages, and also explain these names and record the basically all of the stories of the old people. And they were called the Fudoki, and one of the few that are still extant is the Izumo Fudoki. And interestingly, here Susanoo also appears, but he's very different. So he's not a very important figure here. And he's only mentioned basically as the father of other deities. So he does not, even his fight with the eight-headed dragon is not even mentioned here. So again, we have a very, very different image of Susanoo, which has caused some scholars to question whether Susanoo is actually really a deity from Izumo, because he's very, very strongly connected to Izumo in the imperial chronicles, but not so much in the Fudoki. So what is interesting about this is that, of course, this Susanoo from the Izumo Fudoki did not play a role at all in modern discourses, but that, yes. So as I said, you need something to build on. So you cannot invent traditions from scratch, but you're rather free of choosing what you want to use if there is kind of a precedent. And in the case of Susanoo, this was clearly the Nihon Shoki, which was most useful in this regard.
Okay, yeah, interesting. Different occasions from different texts, and for those who are sort of going to pick up the book, you'll sort of learn that they are sort of used in various different ways as well. And you actually, you know, you look at sort of medieval sort of reinterpretations of Susanoo as well. But why don't we go straight to the second part and sort of just jump straight into the modern sort of period. So this is chapter 6. And here, what I find really interesting is sort of this theory of common ancestry, which you've also mentioned earlier, because that seems to be one of the key sort of points that scholars and sort of individuals sort of part of the Japanese government in terms of applying sort of Susanoo and its sort of his relationship to Korea. Can you maybe tell us more about sort of this theory? Who were some of the main proponents of the theory, and maybe how influential was this during that time?
Mm-hmm. This is a very good question. So first, it is very important to notice that this theory was not so much political idea in the beginning. So the first people who came up with this idea of basically this, well, ancient unity or shared ancestry of Japanese and Koreans were actually the first generation of professors at the Department of Japanese History at the Imperial University of Tokyo. So this was in 1890. The first publications came out that were very heavily based on interpretations of the ancient Japanese myths, especially of those isolated variants. And they did not really draw any political conclusions from this. So they just more or less criticized the Kokugaku scholars like Motori Norinaga and said they have got it all wrong. In reality, there's a very close cultural connection to Korea. And at the time, this view was not influential at all, and it was heavily criticized. And in the end, it was actually one of the reasons why this whole department of Japanese history was closed down after some years, and all three professors who were working there lost their jobs. And it was only then there were some other proponents in afterward, but the theory only became really influential in 1910, when the annexation of Korea to Japan was basically made official. And by then, it was not so much as a scholarly theory, but much more as a mass media phenomenon. So a lot of anthropologists or historians or linguists published not only in scholarly journals, but also in newspapers and in magazines that were targeted at a much broader audience, and basically brought forth this idea that Japanese and Koreans belong together because they had been, they can be traced to a common root. And in all of these articles, the myths played a very important role, because many of them basically interpreted those myths as true historical accounts. So the deities that appeared in those myths were for them historical personages, kings or rulers or village heads. And then this theory again quieted down rather soon, and it was not very influential in among Korean subjects. So it never got a lot of traction on the Korean peninsula. This changed to a certain extent in 1919, which is the year when there was a huge anti-colonial uprising in the peninsula. And after that, the colonial authorities basically reformed their policies on the peninsula, and they introduced something called the cultural rule. So they tried to make the colonial rule appear much more civilian and not so much. So the role of the military was basically downgraded to a certain extent. And then again, this idea of a close relationship, of a close cultural and ethnical relationship of Japanese and Koreans was taken up again, and also influenced Shinto policies. And for the first time, it was also embraced by the government general in Japan. But still, the attitude of politicians was always somewhat ambivalent. On the other hand, Shinto priests in Japan, especially in Japan, not so much in Korea, started to really support this idea, and also support the idea of enshrining Susanoo in Shinto shrines, but also enshrining Korean deities in Shinto shrines. And one basically theory that was used to back this up was that Susanoo was in reality identical with Tangun, with basically the mythical founder of the oldest Korean state. So here, it's very interesting that basically this medieval concept of identifying foreign deities with native deities that had been completely abolished in the modern period reemerged in a very new guise. So that's what for me makes this, especially the colonial interpretations, very interesting. So it started as a purely academic theory that was very much opposed to the mainstream. And then the political utility was basically just discovered later on, which also shows you that, in cultural memory studies or also the invention of tradition, the intention of the writers is not always that important. So it doesn't always work out the way they want to.
Yeah, I think sort of this part is especially what's really interesting about this book, and why I think it's really relevant too, because even now we still see sort of similar processes, right, of like incorporating certain parts, certain ideas from myths, and then actually sort of, believing maybe is not the right term, but actually sort of discussing that as real facts, right? I mean, just even how sort of the Japanese government sort of counts the order of succession, as you know, is still based on the myths. It's still a very sort of relevant thing, even in sort of contemporary Japan. Yeah, really interesting. There's still so much more to discuss, but I'm afraid we've taken way too much of your time. Before we say goodbye, though, there is one final question. Can you maybe tell us what projects you're currently working at?
Sure. So I've basically just started work on a new project that is very much connected to the emergence of modern or the modern discipline of ethnology in Japan. And this focuses on a scholar called Okama Sao, who is very interesting because he bridges Japanese traditions very much with new Western ideas. But this did not happen in the Meiji period, as is often the case, but actually in the Showa period. So he first was a close acquaintance of Yanagita Kunio and also published a journal together with him. And then in the 1930s, he went to Vienna and there studied basically the theory of ethnology that was then very much prevalent in the German-speaking countries, at least, which had a very strong emphasis on cultural migrations and was opposed to the idea of evolution and of basically, you know, separate processes in different countries. But it was for this for the German-speaking countries, there was basically this idea that only very few geniuses will ever have new ideas and can come up with innovations, and everything else is just migrations, and one culture will learn everything from other cultures. And well, Okama Sao learned this theory in Vienna and then wrote a very long book, which he handed in as a PhD thesis in Vienna, which tried to apply this idea to Japanese ethnogenesis. And this theory of ethnogenesis remained very influential. He never really published this in pre-war Japan because it was very much opposed to the mainstream of Japanese scholarship. For instance, it claimed that the Tenno dynasty came at a very late point into the Japanese islands and was not connected to Japan at all, but was basically came over from the continent. And this was later turned into this idea that horse riding people from the Korean Peninsula had basically invaded Japan in the ancient period and built this Tenno dynasty. So that's what I'm working on, and I'm especially interested in how Okama Sao combines ideas taken from Japanese folklore studies with ideas that he encountered in Europe, and how this hybrid process brought forth something very new. Because also one of the major differences between Okama Sao and European scholars of ethnology is that Okama Sao applies these theories to his own culture instead of some very distant, often non-literate society. So here I think it's also very interesting to look at this from a post-colonial perspective and what this actually means. So yeah, that's my new project.
Yeah, that sounds like another fascinating project. Well, if you are interested in learning more about Susanoo and sort of his relationship with Korea, please do check out David's book. Thank you for listening, and I'll see you in another episode of New Books in Japanese Studies. Bye-bye.